So today we will be doing, like I just said in my prayer, the Q&A for Exodus. If you've never been here for a Q&A, this is something that Caleb and I like to do. And by Q&A, as I've been saying throughout the series, what we don't mean by that is that I'm going to sit up here and just take random questions. We do like to prepare the answers so that we can hopefully give you a good or as best as we can answer to questions that we get. And I've been collecting them throughout the series. Some questions I've just given people an answer right away as like either a quick thing or just something that was more just a personal question they had. I've received questions that I never gave somebody an answer for, and some of them, those of you who asked me, might sound familiar because it's questions that you asked me, and I'm actually going to address them again publicly because I felt like they're a really good thing to just share their either a more extended thought or just something. Honestly, a lot of them were things that as I was preparing for various sermons, I wish I had had time to deal with it. But because Caleb and I try very hard, especially when we're working through a whole book and taking chapters at a time, we try very hard to stay to the point, the main point of the text, and not go off on a bunch of sidebars and tangents of stuff that is really cool, but would honestly just make the sermon like 2 or 3 hours long. So we try not to do that. And because of that, there is usually, especially in a book of this size, there is so much that we just don't have time to cover. So we like taking this Q&A to hit some of those things that we didn't get time for. I like that some of the questions actually get at how we read and interpret the text itself. So some of the questions will be along that line. And I will be addressing the questions in the order that they appear in the text. Some of them are broader questions, but kind of I took them in order of like where they at least kind of start the idea or the question starts in the text. So the first one comes from Exodus chapter 9. And specifically, Exodus chapter 9, verse 6. And this is in the middle of the fifth plague, where the livestock die. And 9, verse 6 says, "The next day, the Lord did this thing. All the livestock of the Egyptians died, but not one of the people, not one of the livestock of the people of Israel died." The question is, we read in the fifth plague here in 9:6 that all the livestock of the Egyptians died. What's kind of confusing, though, and interesting is that livestock and beasts keep appearing. There are livestock or beasts mentioned in the sixth, the seventh, and the tenth plagues. So if we read all the livestock died, why do livestock keep coming back is the question. That's a really good question. It's a good catch. A seeming contradiction that I didn't address during the sermon. And at the time of the sermon, and then also like kind of reminding myself and rereading again in prep for this question, I read through many creative ways that commentators worked around this question. And when they did those creative explanations, it was because they were taking this all as an each and every all, like every individual livestock or every individual animal in totality died, and then they keep appearing, so you have to like, okay, well, what does that mean then? Why, how did it all die, and then they keep coming back? The word translated all, though, has a range of possible meanings, just like it does in English. It can mean each and every one. It can mean all as a hyperbole or exaggeration of many, so basically like a generality, all. Like, a lot of times when we use the word all, we really just mean like a lot. It's the same. It can do the same thing in Hebrew. And it can also mean all sorts or all types. So not all as in each and every individual one, but all as in each and every type or each and every sort. Especially when you're talking about something about livestock, like livestock isn't just one type of animal. It's actually a variety of types of animals. I think that this is the last one fits the context here the best, since we do read that livestock and beasts keep reappearing in the narrative. So like the narrative itself kind of tells us which of the understandings, which of the best translations of all we should probably follow. Because if you take it each and every, like the narrative itself contradicts that. So because they do keep reappearing in the narrative, and then also I feel like this explanation, the all as in all types, also matches the whole point of the plagues. In the discussion between Pharaoh and Moses during the previous plague, so again, we're in the fifth plague here and looking forward, but back in the fourth plague, there's a discussion between Pharaoh and Moses where Pharaoh says that the people can go and make the sacrifices that Moses is requesting that they go be allowed to do. But Pharaoh's like, okay, well, you can do that. Just stay in the land and do that. And Moses is like, well, we can't do that, because if we do our sacrifices, we sacrifice types of animals that you and your people consider sacred, and we're about to get into that why, so they might stone us. So we have to go outside of your territory in order to make these sacrifices so that we aren't putting ourselves in jeopardy. Because even if you put out an order, like, your people are probably going to be so offended that we're still going to be under threat if we do that here in your land. And what's interesting is, because of this, because of the fact that, like, Israel can't make these sacrifices because how the Egyptians view their gods and how they represent their gods, God actually kind of flips the tables then on the Egyptians in the very next plague and kind of plays off of what had just happened. Because the Egyptians actually used many different types of livestock to represent many of their gods, which is why the Israelites would have been in trouble if they had sacrificed some of those types of livestock in the land of Egypt. So then what the very next plague does, this attack directly on the livestock, what it does is it puts the gods of Egypt represented by those livestock under attack. And if we take it as each and every type of livestock dies in this plague, then what's happening is each and every god represented by all the different types of livestock is under attack. There is no god of Egypt that is safe from this plague. So to me, that understanding that each and every type, I think that matches the narrative that we keep seeing the livestock show up. I also think it matches the whole point of the plagues, and we talked a lot about that. And in the plagues, how it's this polemic, this attack on the gods to show that Yahweh is greater than any god of Egypt or Pharaoh himself, who was thought to be an incarnation of one of the gods. So the each and every type fits right into that theme, because there is no god, no type of livestock was exempt from this plague. There was no single god represented of Egypt who was not being judged by Yahweh. So that's where I'm now, and I feel like that's the best way to understand what's going on with that all there and why they aren't all each and every one killed and they keep coming up. And then as we continue on the topic of the plagues, another question that was asked was, are there historical records about the devastation to Egypt from the plagues? And if there are, how long did it then take them to recover? Now, this is an interesting question that you might be a little disappointed in my answer, because it's going to be a little bit of a non-answer. And that is because answering this question is tricky. Because in order to know the answer to this question, you have to choose which of the dates of Exodus you're going to land on. Because there are actually two prominent dates that scholars will argue for about the Exodus. There's an early date and a late date. The early date is around 1446. The late date is around 1270. And I really don't have much time to get into the complexities of deciding which one is more likely. That would be an entire series of sermons in itself. But there are really good arguments either way. Many people are familiar with the late date, as this is actually what is portrayed in the movies, like Prince of Egypt or Ten Commandments. Like any movie or portrayal that has Ramses, that's a late date. The early date was under the reign of Thutmose III. For this specific question about evidence of was there like a decline in Egypt or devastation to Egypt, how long did it take them to recover? What's interesting is that actually if you look at both of those dates, both of those time periods, there is evidence of terrible years in the annals or the records of Egypt when they keep track of their philosophers or their poets are talking about it. There are records and evidence of terrible years and of military setbacks that may refer to the events of the Exodus in both time periods. What I find also encouraging and interesting about the whole debate about, like, okay, was it the early date or the late date? What I find interesting about this whole debate is that we have not just one, but two possible times in history that we can look at, and we can look at what we've found from archaeology and from historical records and say, this might work here. There are a lot of pieces of the puzzle that fit, that match what we read in the Bible, that match what we know from history. There have actually even been secular archaeologists and scholars that have looked at Exodus, looked at the evidence from Egypt, and have to admit that, I mean, this is possible. Now, they may not like the miracles or whatever, but they look at the history and they're like, this is a thing that would fit in what we know of history. And what I find really cool about that is that I think that is, honestly, a really strong argument for the historicity of the Exodus. And I think that it should be encouraging rather than discouraging to us that we have not one but two times in history that a lot of the pieces of what we know of history fit into what we know of the Exodus narrative. So rather than being discouraged, like, well, which one do I choose? I choose to just be encouraged by the fact that it could be either one and that it would fit in history either way. So that's where I'm going to end that one. I know that's, sorry, that's kind of a non-answer. But I just want to end on that note of, to me at least, what is encouraging that it could go either way. Moving from the plagues to the crossing of the sea, I had a couple people ask me to clarify more what I meant by the Reed Sea as a better translation of the Red Sea. And crossing the sea, we're obviously in chapters 13 through 15 at this point. So in 13:18, God leads the people toward the what we read as the Red Sea. I'm actually going to read the verses there. So starting in 13, verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. And then I'm going to skip forward a little bit here. And then picking up verse 20, they moved from Succoth and camped to Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them and talked about the pillar of cloud and fire. And I'm going to skip to the beginning of 14. The Lord said to Moses, tell the people of the land to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal-Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. So it's interesting trying to follow the narrative here, trying to follow the travel logs. Essentially what's happening is God is leading the people toward the Red Sea. And why I argue a better translation is Sea of Reeds is that the word that we have translated there, red, is literally the word for reed. So like if you want a literal translation per se, Sea of Reeds is actually literally what's being said in the Hebrew. So he was leading them towards this Sea of Reeds. But then in 14:2, they turn around and then they encamp by the sea. If you look at the beginning of 14 there, it's not specified what sea it is referring to. So what's interesting is they're being led toward the Sea of Reeds, and then they turn around and they encamp by the sea. Are we still talking about the same sea? Like, what is going on? It's kind of gets a little hard to track. Okay, well, what sea is this now then that we're referring to? Is this the Sea of Reeds? Is this a different sea? And before I go any further, I should probably explain more a little bit about the traditional understanding of the crossing of the Red Sea. It might be helpful to have a map up here, but there's the Red Sea, and then there's the Sinai Peninsula, and on each side, looking from your way, the right would be over here. So there's like the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba. And traditionally, on the northern tip of the Gulf of Suez, which is a gulf, but it's part of the Red Sea as it becomes the gulf in there. Like traditionally, that's understood to be where the crossing is. And so even with that, when we say cross the Red Sea, it's traditionally understood to be the Gulf of Suez, which is part of the Red Sea network. And I pause there to explain that because that's going to get important as we keep explaining what's going on here. So all that to say, like they've gone towards the sea and then back encamped by the sea. Which sea is it? Well, in Numbers 33, 8 through 10, we read that the people passed through the midst of the sea, which sea is not specified in Numbers 33. And then they go 3 days to Marah and then to Elim, and then they camp by the Sea of Reeds. So in Numbers 33, it seems that what they passed through is not the Sea of Reeds. And then in Exodus 14, the name of the sea is actually never specified. It is just referred to as the sea. In chapter 15:4, though, part of Moses' song, it says that this was the Sea of Reeds. And then in 15:22, it says that immediately after the parting of the sea and the crossing of the sea, that they set out from the Sea of Reeds. So I know that's kind of a little confusing. So I'm going to summarize what's happened so far. We're going towards the Sea of Reeds, then we come back by the sea. And then if you combine Numbers and Exodus, it seems that this was and wasn't the Sea of Reeds. So like that's pretty much where the text stands so far. And then what's also interesting about the literal reading of Sea of Reeds that should clue us into the fact that something is going on here is that reeds grow by fresh water. This is why Moses was placed by his mother among the reeds of the Nile River, because the Nile is fresh water. The Red Sea, however, and the Gulfs, the Red Sea and the Gulfs, contain some of the world's hottest and saltiest seawater. Thus, reeds do not grow along it. But reeds do grow along the network of lakes and canals that connect the Gulf of Suez, the left arm of the Red Sea, to the Mediterranean, and they grow along the north tip of the Gulf of Aqaba at the top of the right arm, where freshwater springs actually allow for the growth of reeds and freshwater plants. And the Gulf of Aqaba, by the way, which is the gulf that points up at Israel, the very northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba was at one point in Israel's kingdom the very southern tip of the kingdom of Israel. Because of the presence of reeds at the two northern extremes, Sea of Reeds seems to be a shorthand way of referring to the entire Red Sea network. So like I said earlier, how when we say Red Sea, and like the traditional understanding is that the people cross through the Gulf of Suez, we still can call it the Red Sea, because when we say Red Sea, a lot of times we mean the sea and the gulfs. Well, the ancient phrase, Sea of Reeds, actually extended that even a little bit further, and it was the sea, the Red Sea, the two gulfs, and then also a network of canals and lakes that connected the Gulf of Suez to the Mediterranean Sea, which is right on the side of Egypt. And what's also interesting is that the name of one of the places in 14:2, Pi-Hahiroth, likely means mouth of the canal, which may be a reference to somewhere in the network of lakes and canals above the Gulf of Suez. Modern satellite imageries and ancient descriptions of this area in Egypt prove that there was an extensive network of canals and lakes that would have required the miracle that we know of as the crossing of the Red Sea to be crossed on foot. When you put all this together, I think it is a fair guess to say that they might have crossed somewhere in the canal lake network and then later camped by the Gulf of Suez, both of which were considered part of the Red Sea, Sea of Reeds network. This would also explain why it's like, and if you follow the narrative and try to keep up with like what's happening in Sea of Reeds, if they are or aren't there, it's like they do and don't cross through it, because the canal network is considered part of the Red Sea Sea of Reeds network. So if that was super confusing, I'm sorry, but that's honestly like, if you try to research into most places of where stuff happens on the Exodus, it gets convoluted really fast. But all that to say, to summarize what I meant by the Reed Seas, like Reed Sea is just a literal translation, and because the word red is actually reed. And the reed, where the Reed Sea gets its name, is that the two northern tips of the gulfs both had reeds. So because of that, the whole network was considered the Sea of Reeds. And that's how it's used throughout the Old Testament. We have a lot of like places we actually do know of where stuff happened in the Old Testament, and it's like anywhere along the gulfs or in the canal network, stuff happens, and it's all referred to as the Sea of Reeds. So all that to say, I'm going to fall back on something that I've said a few times about the uncertainty of especially where places are in Exodus, and say that God in his grace has allowed us to honestly just not have another place to idolize, because there's just so many unknowns. I think it's a decent explanation to say they crossed somewhere in the canals, and then they were down immediately by the Gulf of Suez, but I'm not like completely sold on that. I think that wherever you take it, it's like somewhere in the network. So that's, sorry, another little bit of a non-answer, but I just wanted to show a little bit of the complexity there for the Sea of Reeds. And the complexity and uncertainty actually leads perfectly into the next question. So the next question is, you keep pointing out uncertainties in the text, which is just a great start. How can we be true to the uncertainties and honest about them, while still also conveying confidence in the Bible itself and its authority to ourselves and also to those we talk about or talk to about the Bible, especially the unsaved and the skeptical? I like this question because it kind of calls me out on something I've been doing a lot, which is just saying, I don't know, to a lot of stuff. But I also like it because it gives me another opportunity to explain why. And I like how the question was worded also, in that it's an attempt to do what I've been trying to do this whole time, which is be honest and frank about the fact that there are things in the text that are difficult, that we do not know for certain. There are words, there are items, there are gems, there are even the Urim and the Thummim. There are things in the text that I cannot give you a 100% for certain concrete explanation of where it was, what exactly it looked like, or any number of details. There are quite a few of those things, especially in the book of Exodus, and honestly, Caleb in Ezra, Esther, Nehemiah is going to have a fun time with the books that he's looking through too, because that historical time period is very interesting to study into. So he's going to run into some difficulties as well. But the question is, how do you be honest about that? and also still convey confidence in the Bible and its authority? This question can get very bogged down in manuscript evidence and textual criticism, but I think that the heart of this question, and I did confirm this with the questioner, by the way, the heart of this question is the fact that we just simply don't know what certain words, places, or practices mean, even among scholars. So that uncertainty about, like, we know what the words are, we know that they're supposed to be there, we just don't know what they mean. That uncertainty is what I want to address. And I like this, again, because it forces us to grapple with this, be honest about this. And how do we answer someone who asks us how we can teach authoritatively from and have confidence in a book in which there are things that we just don't know? I think the best way to answer this question is to first ask ourselves what things we are focusing on and teaching authoritatively from the text. In my research for Exodus, I have run across entire sections of commentaries, blog posts, and sermons that have entirely focused on and spiritualized details that we honestly are not sure about, driving home an application, sometimes a very long application, based on a guess. The details are part of an overall picture of what is being taught, and we can often understand what is being taught even while maybe not understanding every individual detail. Caleb was actually just talking about this in Sunday school with some of the parables and stuff he was working through. Even in this uncertainty, though, we can still teach authoritatively and have confidence in the word when we stick to what the text is actually trying to teach. There is so much that we can know. There is so much that we have verified historically. And our understanding of this book written so long ago, but still very much alive today, is always improving. It is not a mark against the authority and reliability of the Bible that it used ancient, culturally understandable words, places, practices, and ways of writing and speaking to communicate its message. It is a mark, in fact, of its historicity and the fact that God desires to teach in ways that people will understand. It is our job today to take what is being taught and make that message, the main point of the text, make that message heard today. Because the Bible did its job in that day. There are details and places and things that made sure the message was understood. We may not catch every detail, we may not know exactly where every place is, but we can communicate what the text is trying to communicate. We may not know, for example, where every individual stopping point was located on the Exodus journey, but those locations weren't the point. What God was doing in his deliverance of the people was the point. So I know that that honestly, as there are a lot of questions in this Q&A that I don't give a hard and fast answer. But that is how I have sought to teach the book of Exodus. That's why I've tried to be honest about things that I just don't know. And it's also why I've taken, at times, many chapters at a time, try to focus on the main point and keep our eyes on what the text is actually trying to teach in each section. So that's where I'll close that question. The next question comes from Exodus chapter 18. And this question is, you have mentioned multiple times that there are a lot of connections in the text with the rest of the story of Bible. I've made a lot of mention of, like, there are entire veins of biblical theology that I just don't have time to get into, or, like, there are entire nuggets here that you can unpack and, like, just trace it throughout the Bible, and there's, like, so much in each chapter that I just have not had time to get to. So I've said that a lot, and the question is, can you give an example? So I chose to do this from chapter 18. And if you want to, like, I'm obviously can't do a whole sermon on chapter 18. I dealt with it at the time in, I think, chapter 16 through 18. I did all at once. But because I don't have time for a whole sermon, I did actually find a really good one from another church in the area. So Pastor Dan Miller at Eden Baptist Church has a really good sermon on just chapter 18. And I really appreciated what he did with it, because he picked up on one of the veins of biblical theology that I just didn't have time to get to. And I'm going to give, like, the highlights of his sermon that he walked through in chapter 18. So in chapter 18, this is where the I explained at the time, this is kind of like a flash forward chronologically. The people have not arrived at Sinai yet, but in chapter 18, they are at Sinai, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, arrives and gives him some advice. He sees what he's doing, sees that he is sitting there all day hearing all of the people's, all their requests and cases, and he is alone judging everything. And then Jethro looks at him and says, the thing you are doing is not good. You need to appoint some judges and delegate this task. So that's like the summary of what happens in this chapter. What's interesting is if you look at 18 verse 12, it says, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. The key phrase there at the end there, before God. Is Jethro an Israelite? No. He's a Midianite. But you have in this verse, you have a communion of Israelites and non-Israelites rejoicing in the presence of God, before God, possibly in the presence and before that pillar that's before them right now. You have communion of those rejoicing in the presence of God and the deliverance that God has provided. Man, if that ain't a picture of communion. A picture of the New Testament when it spreads out and goes to the whole world. You have Jews and Gentiles, and we look in Revelation, you have an innumerable and uncountable multitude having the marriage supper of the Lamb. I think that right there, this is a kernel of what is to come. And then Jethro tells in chapter 18, 19 through 20, Jethro tells Moses to focus on prayer and teaching. If you read 19 through 20, it says, he tells Moses to represent the people before God and bring their cases to God, and then warn them about the statutes and the laws and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do. In other words, tells them to focus on representing God, representing the people before God and bringing their cases to God. That sounds an awful lot like prayer, because it is. And then he tells Moses also to focus on warning them about the statutes and laws and make them know to teach them the ways of God in which they must walk and what they must do. These are interestingly the exact same things the apostles say they must focus on when they become overwhelmed and must delegate tasks of ministry in Exodus 6:4, where it says, they say, we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word, when there is a time when they must delegate tasks to deacons. Which, speaking of deacons, there's another thing, another vein right there, that starts back here in Exodus 18. The choosing of the judges and their qualifications sounds very similar to the choosing of the deacons and their qualifications given in Acts 6, verse 3. And then finally, there's a pattern of even leaders needing to humble themselves and listen to wise counsel. And this is a pattern that I don't really need in a specific verse, because it's like literally the entire New Testament is that we are all called to humble ourselves and listen to wise counsel as we honor each other and respect each other and push each other towards Christlikeness. Even leaders are called to this. So in Exodus chapter 18, you have, in the words of Pastor Dan Miller, you have patterns of the people of God. And I really like that, because Exodus 18, you have all of these pictures of what is to come with the church, and then even pointing forward to Revelation. So that's just like a little snippet of a whole vein of biblical theology that I just didn't really have time to get to. And that comes from chapter 18. The next question comes from chapter 23, verse 19. And yes, it is in the covenant code, all the laws. So chapter 23, verse 19. The question is, could you explain the command to not boil a young goat in its mother's milk a bit more? It seems very random, but it is given three times in the Pentateuch, so it must be important. Does it teach something about God's character? I was wondering if this one would come back up. I addressed it very briefly in the sermon, and I was wondering if someone was going to ask about that again. So this gives me an opportunity to explain it a bit more. And the three instances that it comes up, by the way, is 23:19 in the covenant code the first time, and then in 34, verse 26, we see it again in the renewal of the covenant, and then in Deuteronomy 14:21 in the second giving of the law, which is why it's called Deuteronomy, we see it again. The fact especially that in 34, and if you turn there, turn to chapter 34, this renewal of the covenant. You just came from chapter 23, and in 20 through 23, 4, 20 through 23, you have like four whole chapters, because 20, 21, 22, 23, yeah, you have four whole chapters of the covenant code the first time. And then in chapter 34, you have the renewal of the covenant. And if you look at 34, like the covenant renewed, like if you just go by the heading of the ESV, in 10 to 28. So you just have like part of a chapter of the covenant renewal. So you have like a very short list of representative commands given in the renewal of the covenant. And at the very end here, if you look in, what verse is it? I just lost my reference here. 26, thank you. So in 26, if you look there, it says, the best of the first fruits of the ground you shall bring to the house of the Lord, and you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. So even on this very short list of the covenant renewal, this strange command makes the list. So what is going on? I think that the end of the question, that does this teach something about God's character, I think this hits the nail on the head. I have said many times while we were talking about all the covenant laws that they are an expansion and an application of the Ten Commandments, which are the heart of the law. They are an expansion and application of these commandments to the people to help them apply the Ten to their context. We know that Jesus also summarized all the commands even more narrowly than the Ten and gave not ten, but two. He said that all the law hangs on loving God and loving others. All the commands are about learning to live out godly love in every context to reflect God's love and character in every facet of life. So how does this command fit in? In that grand theme of like summarized by the ten and then by Jesus summarized by the two, do not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. How does that fit in to this theme here? Well, the two occurrences in Exodus are in the context of festival laws. And then in Deuteronomy, it occurs in the closing, it closes a section of dietary laws. So it seems that this is something to do with how they prepared goat meat, especially during festivals. Newborn goats, culturally, were considered a delicacy. They were often born around the time of the festival of ingathering, and it was a common cultural practice to take a newborn goat whose meat was considered rare, like a rare delicacy, and they would boil it in their mother's milk. God, though, considered this insensitive and forbids this. This matches a few other laws that command care and consideration of animals as we seek to be good, wise, and loving stewards of God's creation. Remember back in Exodus 1 where we're told to be stewards, to go subdue and have dominion over the earth? That doesn't mean that we like go with swords hacking everything and killing all of the animals. Like we're supposed to practice wisdom and discretion and care as we are stewards of the earth. These laws, there are a few of them, these laws about animals prohibit things such as slaughtering both the young and the mother on the same day. We see this in Leviticus 22:28. Deuteronomy 22:6-7 is another place we see it. There's a law against yoking together an ox and a donkey, two animals of unequal strength. And there's also a command against muzzling an ox while it is threshing, thus preventing it from eating while laboring. Deuteronomy 22:6-7 is especially noteworthy. It says, if you come across a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs and the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you and that you may live long. It closes with the same promise of reward given for honoring your parents. That also seems really random. Like there's this big promise here given by not killing a mother and its children of chicken. It seems really random. This law was understood as a way of honoring parents. Yes, even animal parents. It was also seen as a way to conserve natural resources and animal populations and prevent the extinction of the animals that God created. Because if you go around killing the parents and the children, you are killing the entire line. So it's a way of preventing extinction. The commands regarding animals then forbid ruthless, callous treatment of animals, even in a society that sacrificed many of those very animals. So I just wanted to give a little bit more time to that and say that these laws about love God, love others, and how we live, how we act in every manner of life, even extends to how we care for animals, which are, guess what, part of God's creation. And we are to care for them, be good stewards of them. As we move on to the next question, This question is more of a broad question, so there isn't really like one specific verse or anything for it. So I'll just say it broadly covers Exodus 25 to 31. And the question is, if the tabernacle and sacrifices were a visible Bible to the people, and I use that phrase many times, that like the tabernacle, how it was built, everything that was used, the pictures, the cherubim, everything, it was a visible Bible, the incense and the sacrifices, the smoke and all the smells and everything, it was a visible, tangible Bible. I use that phrase a lot about what was going on. So if it is this visible, tangible Bible, is there any way for a foreigner or a sojourner to read that Bible if they wanted to believe in God? I think it's a pretty good question. Because if you think about the tabernacle, like who's in the tabernacle? The priests are primarily in the tabernacle. And when we read it, it's easy for us to forget about the fact that actually a mixed multitude came out with the Israelites from Egypt. So we read it and we think this thing is primarily just for all of the native Israelites. But this question is wondering about, like, what about the mixed multitude? What about people who are visiting Israel or see them as they're traveling around or interact with them or mingle with them? Like, are they able to glean anything from this visible, tangible Bible that I've been talking about so much, this tabernacle and all the pictures that are happening here? There are multiple ways to answer this question, but I'd like to first actually think about the normal Israelite, the non-priest, and how much access they had to the tabernacle. Only the priests were allowed inside the tent of meeting. So what most people saw was just the outer courtyard hangings, the outer layers of the tent, which was basically just leather, and the courtyard itself when they went there to offer sacrifices. They may have seen more while it was being taken down and rebuilt, and many had helped, as we read, in the construction of the parts and furnishings, but much of it was covered, even while being transported. So even the non-priest Israelite, there were many parts of this visible, tangible Bible that I've been talking about that they just never saw. The priests then had access to more of this visible, tangible, sensory Bible, and they were supposed to teach the people. The people had access to the teachings offered through the priests and leaders and the teachings given in the practices of the sacrificial system and the laws that ordered the various aspects of their lives. The tabernacle and sacrifices then were but the center of what was supposed to be an entire society that was a visible, tangible, sensory Bible. It wasn't just the tabernacle, and especially if you think back about last year in my series through Leviticus about the sacrificial system and what was all being taught there, the tabernacle, how it looked, the sacrificial system, how that worked, and then the covenant code, all these laws that have to do with every aspect of life, the entire society centered, yes, at the tabernacle, but filtering out through the entire society, it was all, every person was supposed to be part of this visible Bible to the world around them. Why do you think they're called a kingdom of priests? They're all supposed to be picturing and teaching what God is teaching them. They are supposed to be a flesh and blood Bible, if you will, lived in the world. Every detail of the tabernacle and sacrifices taught something to those who went there and those who taught there. Foreigners, depending on their resident status and obedience to various laws applied to them, and especially whether or not they were circumcised as the sign of their total commitment to the faith of the Israelites, foreigners were given certain privileges and access to sacrifices and festivals. So if you want to think about it just in that light, like how close to the tabernacle, how many of the sacrifices could they do? Were they involved in festivals? Like, you can read through the Old Testament and it talks about different tiers of like, well, if you're like this much of a proselyte, if you're circumcised, if you're from this place or whatever, like there are different tiers of how much access they might have. But even if they were just a temporary visitor, the goal of this society and these pictures that God is setting up, the goal is that they would be immersed in a society that embodied the teachings that were centered at the tabernacle. And that is what would draw them to God. Another way of thinking about this answer, I think, is to put it in a modern setting, is that people, your neighbors, people may not come here to this building, to a service like this, where we teach and where we think about these things and where we sing. They may never come here, but they may interact with you, where God has put you. So the question then is if somebody, to put it back in the terms of the question, if a foreigner, a sojourner, somebody who doesn't come to this church, if what they interact with is you. Are you a flesh and blood Bible? Are you a tangible, sensory Bible living what is being taught and what we believe about the Word? So that's how I would choose to answer that question, is that, no, they may not have full access into the tabernacle, but even the non-priest Israelites didn't have full access into the tent of meeting. But I think the bigger question is, when they came into Israelite society, what were they learning? And that's also what the prophets focus on when they say that you have become a byword among the Gentiles, is that your society, you as an entire people, are a blight upon the reputation of God. Because the world is not learning and seeing what you are supposed to be. So in our modern setting, I would frame it in the way that we are to be a visible Bible to the world around us, just like Israel was supposed to be a visible Bible, whether or not people had access to the tabernacle. The next question is, how do Christians, this question is kind of a calling out of something I said in the Golden Calf sermon. The question is, how do Christians seek improperly and impatiently for God's presence today? And this comes from chapter 32, which is where the people make the golden calf. The question is in reference to a comment I made about the golden calf and how people built it because they had become impatient for God's timing and chose rather to bring God's presence into the camp in their own way rather than continue to wait for Moses. I said at this time that this impatience for God's timing or for the next phase of his plan could be an entire sermon in and of itself. So this question is kind of calling me out on that, saying, can you talk about that more? So I don't have time for an entire sermon, but it is definitely worth some thought. What I want to first reiterate is something that I explained then and that we often overlook in this narrative. And that is that the impatience of the Israelites is understandable. I think we often too quickly brush by that. Moses had brought them out of Egypt, had been their guide and their mediator between them and God, and he had been their teacher. He is now gone. He is on top of the mountain. The pillar of cloud and fire that had also been with them, been near them, or in their camp, or in front of them, it is also no longer in their presence. The impression we get from the narrative at this point is that Moses and the presence of God, the pillar, are up on top of the mountain. They're just this vague, ominous thing up there for over a month, not in the camp anymore. Their God and their guide, then, are both no longer in the camp, no longer near them, just distantly on top of the mountain. This group of people, having just been in slavery for hundreds of years, having been brought into the wilderness to the base of a mountain near enemy territory, remember, they had just fought the Amalekites not too far from Mount Sinai, and they have now been left on their own for over a month. They are desperate to have God back in the camp, and they pursue this end the way they think is best. They default to the ways that they are familiar with and that bring them a sense of security, of how they in their culture would bring God back into the camp when he is not feeling present to them. Thinking about it in this light, how many times do we have a spiritual high, a closeness, a feeling of closeness to God, where we see him work in our life, we see him direct us somewhere, or we see him work in the lives of those around us, or we read of his glorious works in Scripture, but then we later feel that he is absent and that we must do something to bring him back. We must do something to get back that feeling of closeness, that high that we were on of our feeling of closeness to God. How many times are we so desperate to hear from him, to seek his presence, to get an answer, to know the next phase of his plan, to see his return, that we pursue one of these goals in a way that we think is best, that brings us a sense of security, all the while dishonoring the very one we claim to be pursuing. Church history is littered with stories of people forcing open doors that God hasn't opened, arrogantly and unlovingly pursuing goals that they claim come from God, but with which he would in no way want to be associated with. Doing things in church services supposedly to bring his presence down or grow his church that violate the very principles they are supposed to be teaching and upholding. Or claiming that they know when Christ is coming back and calling people to ungodly responses to their supposed secret knowledge. The impatience is understandable. The impatience of the Israelites was understandable. Our impatience is understandable. But the improper pursuit is inexcusable. We see that God did not give them an excuse. We don't like waiting. It is one of the hardest things for us to do. But multiple times in Scripture, we are told to wait on the Lord. Even when we don't feel his presence, he is with us. Even when we don't know or are waiting for the next phase of his plan, the current right now phase of his plan is that you wait. And as you wait, he does have a job for you. We are called to love God, to love others, to think on what is true, honorable, just, pure, lovely, commendable, excellent, and worthy of praise, to push each other to Christ-likeness wherever we are while we wait. The Israelites defaulted back to culturally normal ways to gain security, peace, and a feeling of closeness to God. Do we ever do the same? Do we seek things or a feeling that He is here through religious traditions or chasing that spiritual high, through seeking political power or financial stability, or through a drive to find all the answers, even the ones that we can't know? These things have their place, but they will never properly bring us into God's presence if sought in a way that is against His will and what we know. So that is where I'll end that short sermon on that teaching. But I wanted to acknowledge that it is hard. Waiting is hard. But what we do while we wait is the question. And that's what the Israelites were punished for. They weren't punished for the fact that it was hard to wait. They were punished for what they did while they waited. So the question is, are we honoring God when we feel at a time we're stuck, where we are waiting? Because He has things He's told us that we can do. And we might be frustrated that it's taking a long time to know what's coming next, but we can do what He's called us to do right where we are. The last question is, at the Transfiguration, was Moses present because he was someone who had already seen a glimpse of God's glory and spoken with God face to face? I think that this may definitely be an additional layer to what is happening here. I think Moses and Elijah, who is the other one present there, I think that they are highly featured in the Old Testament, that in both of their accounts you have a close and honest and frank relationship between Moses and Elijah, or Moses and God and Elijah and God. You see them both talking to God, and they even both, ironically, have a parting of the sea and walking on dry land account. There's a lot of connections between the two of them. But I think that the primary reason they are there is that they are figureheads for the law and the prophets, which was a summary way of referring to the entire Old Testament. I think they are there because Moses and Elijah's presence signify that the law, pictured through Moses, and then the prophets, pictured through Elijah, both of these pointed to Jesus. And I think that is why, after the Father says, "This is my beloved Son," remember that Peter had interjected and said about the three of them, "This is good that we are here. Let's make a tent for each of the three of you." And then God cut him off and said, "This is my Son. Listen to him." And Peter and the apostles bowed down, and when they looked up, there was just Jesus. Because Moses and Elijah pictured the law and the prophets, pictured the entire Old Testament, the one that they pointed forward to had come. So they step out of the picture, and the apostles then just see Jesus. The one to whom the law and the prophets pointed had arrived. So I think that's primarily what's being pictured there. This is where we'll close our Q&A for today. But as I said at the beginning, feel free to continue to ask questions about Exodus. I would love to continue talking to people more about it. I hope that these past few months in this book have been very helpful and have given you a greater passion for studying this book. Next week is Easter, so Caleb will be doing Matthew 28, and then he'll be starting a series on Ezra, Esther, and Nehemiah. And I am very much so looking forward to those books that we'll be working through together and what God has for us. So let's close today in prayer. Dear Lord, I thank you for this time. I thank you for just the innumerable lessons that we can learn from Exodus. These questions are but a sampling of the many additional thoughts that we just haven't even had time to get into. This book, specifically Exodus, but in the entirety of your word, is a gold mine that never runs out. And I pray that as we study it, as we look to you, that we are doing so properly, that we are seeking your presence to know you, that we are honoring you where we are, and that as we study your word more, as we talk about it with each other, that we would glorify you in your beauty and the beauty of this story of your plan that you have been masterfully unfolding throughout all of history, and how we already know the end. We may not know every detail of the end, but we know that it will be your plan, and that is good enough for us. I pray this in your name. Amen.